The Tom Woods Show, episode 1787.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, this Christmas you may be wondering what to get for the man in your life and you don't want to get another tie or pair of socks. Well, how about a Harry's Holiday Shave Set, a beautiful and practical gift. New customers can get $5 off plus free shipping on any Harry's limited edition holiday shave set when you go to harrys.com/woods. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here, delighted to be joined today by actor and comedian Rob Schneider. If you are my age, actually almost any age, you'll know about Rob Schneider's sketch comedy on Saturday Night Live. He's made many movies since then. He has a brand new Netflix special that we'll talk about. And he's following me on Twitter, and I noticed him reading Mises. And so one thing led to another, and doggone it, I fetched the guy for the program. So delighted to welcome him here. Rob, welcome to the Tom Woods Show.
Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate it. It seems like when things are just about as crazy as can be, they get a little crazier. And I know you just had an issue where something was taken off of something. I keep track of you now. Now I follow you, Tom.
I appreciate that. Yeah, this is the first time I've ever, in years and years and years of making videos, first time I've ever had one taken down. And believe me, I've had some BS videos up there. But this one's full of facts. And I've got citations for everything. But it was saying that the lockdowns are a bad idea. And apparently it's scientifically proven that they're a good idea. So you can't criticize them. It's insane.
Well, it has nothing to do with the truth anymore. It's a propaganda thing now. I mean, it's just when you made the mistake of having an opinion, you know, and also having an opinion that was backed up scientifically, which is even worse. But that's where politics is right now. And that's where science is. When politics and science intersect, the problem is people tend to want to listen to the science that's along the political lines that they're thinking. So it's absolute lunacy, but that's where we are right now.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there's a lot to be said about this. I want to start off, though, by doing something kind of selfish, which is to ask you a couple things that I'm not sure my audience is interested in, but doggone it, as a podcast host, I've done almost 2,000 episodes. I'm entitled to a couple of questions for the old man here. And they have to do with just curiosity about your career, because, you know, a lot of times when I was growing up in the 80s, and people would say, well, you know, and also the 90s. The 90s, I watched a lot of SNL. And people would say, well, the real heyday was when they had John Belushi and Chevy Chase and whatever. And I kind of like that stuff, but I never really got into it the way I did when you guys were on it. So I guess I just need to know a few things just to satisfy my curiosity. How did you get the SNL gig? How does that happen?
Well, you know, it was, you know, the original show, I think the best cast ever was that original cast. I mean, our cast had some really great writers. At that time, the funniest people in the room were the performers, whereas with us, I think our time, the funniest guys were the writers, believe it or not. And, you know, I include myself and like Adam Sandler and, you know, Dana Carvey as like these writers, but like, I think the funniest guys were there. And so what happened was Lorne Michaels brilliantly hired two groups. It was the Lemmings, which was on off Broadway. And then there was a group of the, I guess it was the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And so these groups that had been working together for a while, and he brought these two disparate groups together to form this really brilliant, brilliant as far as timing, but also these young generation of people that was basically the first show, I think, in television that people that grew up on television, and this show was for other people who grew up on television. It was like the parents were taken out of the room. And it was also given a time, it was a very strange, unique time that Lorne Michaels was able to kind of seize, which was Johnny Carson at the time. You have to understand how powerful The Tonight Show was. And this is the time when there were just three networks. This was no cable. This was, pre-1975 now, no HBO. This is when 25% of the network time was for your broadcast rights had to be hard news. Okay, Tom, this is like pre disease of the week, 2020, you know, shows. This is like real stuff. And so what they had was they had to do, you know, real news and stuff. And so this is, and then, so for the profits for the network was Johnny Carson. at one point, Johnny Carson was responsible in the late 60s, after he took over from Jack Parr, he was responsible for 80% of the network's profits.
That's 80%. Insane.
That just, yeah, that'll never happen again in the history of television. So he was doing 90 minutes a week. I'm sorry, 90 minutes a night, 5 nights a week, and a half hour of that was commercials. So there was just pumping money into the network, into NBC. And they also were rerunning his shows on Saturday. And so Carson was like, this is way too much. You guys, you're burning me out, and that's too much. And so, you know, Grant Tinker was like, well, we have to get something else. And Lorne Michaels pitched a show. And one of the things he said he'd written for, like, I think it was like Sonny and Cher or like, one of those type of shows. And he was a comedy team. I forget the other gentleman's name, with Lorne Michaels. And the one lie that he said was he also wrote for Monty Python, which was like probably the biggest influence on for people who were comedy nerds at that time. And you could see the huge influence of Monty Python on Saturday Night Live in those early days, and well into like when I was on there. Those are the high watermark of comedy in the 20th century. So by the time cut to 15 years after that initial time, which doesn't seem very long like right now to me as a man in my 50s, but when you're like watching the show at 13 and then, 15 years later, you're on it is pretty remarkable, you know?
Yeah.
It's less than 15 years. I think like 11 or 12 years later it was on it. So, but most of those guys were on at that point, it was Second City improv performers. And then you had stand-up comedians. And so Dennis Miller was a terrific stand-up and still is. Was directly responsible for having recommending, Adam Sandler, myself, and David Spade too. So
that's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. Now you were there. Were you there? Were you actually there the night Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope?
Yeah, I was there, and it's a weird thing, Tom, because that was one of the shows where, like, I was one of the utility players. I mean, basically, I could have done any voice that pretty much, but like Phil Hartman was the best as far as for announcer type voices, but. For small characters and stuff, I'd hit it out of the box. So I had like I was in 9 sketches that week. And I don't know how many made it to air, but I remembered there's like little moves that you do, Tom. Like, you do like a little shutter move, which is something like, you kind of overreact to something. It always gets a laugh. They're like little go-tos. I guess golfers have their specific, 8-iron to chip it out of the deep rough or something, So comedians and actors have those little perks, those little twerks to their craft as well. And so I was literally changing, and then I was going to another sketch, and I did my little body shift where I do this little double thing or whatever you call it, and it didn't get a laugh. And I said, well, that was kind of weird. And then I went to the next sketch, and it was kind of like a ooh feeling in there, and I don't know what it was. And later, I only found out later that it was at the party. She had ripped up a picture of the Pope, and which was, to me, like a photograph of something or a picture. But I guess it was at a time when it was really, I would say, as far as political activism with celebrities, it was pretty rare. And I think it just, it got so much attention for it for that reason. But yeah, I was there. I didn't witness it, but I was changing, getting into some kind of wig or makeup or costume I was doing. But I was there that night. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. I guess I would have thought that backstage people would have been whispering about it, but you were too busy getting ready and didn't know what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I was just trying to get into my next thing and a wig change or whatever. And so were the other costume people, and so were the other makeup people. They're just, sometimes you can watch a little of the show or something, but like for us in the thick of the, just trying to get the show, the thing I remember a lot was like, let's just get it, people laughing till the news, and then people fall asleep. So there's some sketches that were kind of weak. Hopefully they put them on after. But yet, then again, a lot of the really cool sketches were done in the last half hour of the show. That's when we did like my character, the weed guy, which is like, now the legal marijuana all over, even in red states like Arizona now, where I live, unbelievably, marijuana is legal. So, but like when I was a kid, I walked into this African antiquity store, in upstate in Rochester, this is when I was on the show, and everything in there looked like something that when I remember when I was a kid, my older brother Stan would hide his weed in so my parents wouldn't find it. And so I took it up to the front and I go, where's the weed going here? And the guys, see, the woman actually looked at me like I was some kind of weirdo. But then that was it. That just a simple idea that you could stretch into a 2-3 minute sketch that I ended up doing with Lou Morton, wrote it with me. He's like, this is a, you know, this is a Senegalese. I said, where is the, you know, some guy brings up like a little drum or something or a little thing. Where, what is this for? Oh, that's a Senegalese lute. It's carved from deer wood. It's used for fertility rituals. They make one every 7 years. What do you do with it? You put your weed in there. So it was just, it's yeah. fun to have like rhythms. And a lot of the show is it's a rhythm on a rhythm on a rhythm and a funny idea and perform funny. That, so that's what's, was the perfect place for a young guy like me at that time.
Well, you were mentioning what I kind of assumed had to be the case, that maybe you would rehearse more sketches than when push comes to shove actually wind up on the air. And that makes me wonder, if it's a traditional show that's recorded, it's up to the editors to make the show fit in the slot and have enough room for commercials and stuff. But with a live show,
yeah,
presumably you guys also have to play. Is there like a clock running? How are you doing that?
Well, you know what? That's a very good question. And one of the few people has talked about that. But the what it really is, what Lorne Michaels was able to do was take Weekend Update and use that as an accordion to either contract or expand according to the that week's show's needs. So if he cut some stuff that didn't really work, he would extend that, maybe put another person to do a Weekend Update piece. And then, or if the sketches are going good, they need to contract it and do less time.
Ah.
So that was the mobile, that was the modular part of that show for sure.
All right, that's very clever. Now, also the live aspect of it. I mean, you were a guy in your 20s.
You have to be in your 20s for sure, because it takes it out of you. And if you want to do it right, you got to be there around the clock. And I just remember like looking at my eyeballs one night and, my mom's Filipino, so I have some Asian in me to begin with, but I noticed the difference in, I literally, my eyes were almost shut by the time the live show was, because you'd been up for 100 weeks. I mean, sorry, you've been up for 100 hours by that time that week. So to really be on it and to like to focus and everything, you're just getting tired and more tired. That's why you need guys in their 20s who just, it's the same thing like baseball. You know, it's not there are a lot of guys can hit the ball and whatever, but can you get up the next morning? Can you pack your bags? Can you get on the bus? Can you get on the plane? And then can you do it again? It's that kind of thing. So that's why it's important to get, you know, young people to do that kind of stuff. It's fun, but it really does, I guess the guy who wrote, Jack Nicholson movie that was, he did on Broadway, Cuckoo's Nest. What's his name? Is it Ken Kesey who wrote that?
Yeah, it might be. Yeah.
Yeah. He said Ken Kesey, he's like, you got to do it. And he actually worked at a mental institution. He said, you know, the writing of it, he couldn't have written that in his 50s. It had to be in his 20s because he's just the hours and the night after night. And just, and so I'm glad I did it then.
Yeah.
And it was a thrill. It was a real thrill, because sometimes something would go really good. And then the next thing you know, you're performing it. You're performing on a Saturday Night Live. You think of an idea Tuesday, Saturday night, you're performing it. And then you could be at a grocery store on Sunday and you hear people repeating your bit.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and they don't know you're there. You know, that was the most bizarre thing.
Oh, that's
ever.
Even better.
Yeah, bizarre.
But at the same time, now I'm sure it was exhilarating and amazing, but at least the first few times, there's no getting out of your head that this is... You're going live in front of millions of people. There's no rewind button on this, right?
No, there isn't. But the idea of it, like why they had like stand-ups and other performers, is to not crack under that pressure, because you really have to, if you've been done it time after time after time, and you know, if you're done stand-up like, you know, thousands of times performed by that point, even a guy in my early 20s like I was, I had done stand-up thousands of shows. So at that point, you know the good and the bad, you know not to let it rock you too much, and you know how you can kind of get back on point. And if you're getting laughs, when to cut it off, when to ride it, when to push into the next one. So there's a certain mastery that you have to have, otherwise you can't be there, or otherwise you would never get in that position. And sometimes you'd see some people, you know, you try to take that energy. I was very lucky, because when I was really nervous, I found myself laughing or the smile going up on my side of my face. And Adam Sandler was very similar to that way too. And I remember, but we were both doing a bit with the Italian Waiters, which was based on an experience.
Oh, I remember that one. Well, jeez.
Yeah, Kirstie Alley. Yeah. Well, it's just basically we finally started to make a little bit of money on Saturday Night Live. And then we were able to have girlfriends and then take them out to dinner in Little Italy. And the Italian Waiters were going, bellissima. And they're kissing our girls and hugging them and everything. And I was like, yeah, maybe it's just the custom. And then Adam Sandler and Rob Smigel went off and wrote the sketch, and they brought it to me at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And they were laughing so hard, they literally just handed it to me. They were drooling all over themselves laughing. And then I was reading it, and I literally was falling on the floor laughing.
And well, let's just say, for people who may not remember the sketch, let's just say it's a very, very exaggerated version of what you saw in Little Italy.
Yeah, so very much. So, I mean, like Dana Carvey's got Victoria, you know, Jackson on the table, and these, you know, and then, you know, we're licking Kirstie Alley. So it was a, you have to just, it's kind of taking a part of a life and exaggerating to the point of absurdity. But it was, it just, I remember like he, before the show, he just said, should I shave off all my private parts? I said, yes, yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, because I knew how uncomfortable that would be and how hairy he is. We're sharing a dressing room. And the next thing you know, he's out there basically and like, you know, his rear end is showing and I'm completely naked from the back. And the audience is screaming laughing. And we're 4 feet away. We could barely hear each other talk. But we're looking at each other like, wow, this went really good.
Yeah.
And so it's like that kind of stuff is what I remember the most.
Yeah, sure, sure. But I can't help asking, on live television, did, I mean, obviously this or that little thing might go wrong. Did anything ever really go seriously wrong?
Well, I was on one time, and I think Lorne Michaels would say this one went wrong, was the makeup person or turned down the, you know, the speaker in the makeup room, which, you know, he said never happens, but apparently it did happen because it happened to me. And so this is when Woody Allen and Sun Yi were a couple, which was causing quite a, you know, quite a stir in the tabloids, and especially in New York, which is where he lived. And so we did a cold open with Dana Carvey was playing Woody Allen, and I was playing the only Asian cast member. I was playing Sun Yi by default. And anyway, so I was in the back there doing my hair, trying to make it look nice. I got high heels on. I look up on the screen, and I see Dana Carvey out there by himself, and he's going, "Where's Sun Yi?" I see him mouthing, and I didn't hear. So I ran in high heels back out there, and it was fine. I got out there and time, and Dane and I both memorized and knew what we're doing. We're catching up, but the cue card people were trying to find it. And then, of course, there's certain cast members like Chris Farley who never memorized the stuff, you know. And he walked out. He was always funny, but he never memorized, you know, sketches. Or if he did, I was never part of it. He looked and saw the credit card mess behind us and slapped Woody Allen, played by Dana Carvey, in the back and went like, "You're a real scumbag," which was not the line. Which is supposed to be, "You're a real sleazeball," or "You're kind of a sleazeball."
Okay.
So it made an edge that was unnecessary. And
Okay.
That happened. And Lorne yelled at me in front of everybody, but that was his right. I mean, there's no excuse for that, but it happens. And the thing about it is, like, you know, you never panic and you just got to go out there. And there are guys who handle it. The thing is, your guys can handle it, but you got to handle it and have fun too. And that's the harder part. I remember being in my early 30s in show business and talking to Adam Sandler. We were both doing movies at the time back in our, you know, just right after SNL. And I went like, "Are we enjoying this yet?" Because it was just so much pressure. We were just trying to get through it and just, you know, but like to really get yourself to enjoy it was, you know, what I spent the last, you know, couple of decades trying to make myself do. Because you could get into the pressure and it could crack you and it could be less fun and you just find yourself not having fun. And then actually the reason why you make it, I think, is because of the energy, that excitement about loving what you do so much that it just draws, I think it's like a universal attraction, not to be metaphysical here, but I really think there is something to it. If you're so excited about something so much and you're laughing, some people want to be part of that. And I think that just draws people to you. And the next thing you know, that can happen, but that can go away too. And I think that's part of it is being an artist, finding it again and trying to stay in that more than not stay in it.
You were telling me that you've been doing some shows in minor league baseball stadiums. Is that for the sake of social distancing or whatever?
I mean, I just want to do whatever's allowed. And I think this thing, because I really feel like now I'm sure you can confirm this too, Tom, because I'm following you now, is that it's a very interesting time to talk to people, because I really feel like, you know, stand-up comedy, and I think as also a public speaker like yourself, you really get the sense that people want to connect with you, and they also want you to make sense of the world for them. And it has to do with a combination of factors. I think they're so busy. There's so much distraction. They can get caught in their own, you know, internet echo chamber, and they just, you know, they just don't know what to make of things. So I do think that, like, it's important for speakers like yourself and for, you know, a comedian like me though I have to be careful that I'm not just there to like spout however I'm, you know, whatever I'm feeling about particular issues. I got to be there to entertain. But I think you get at the same time, you can get people to question things. Like, you know, when you say things to people like, you know, there's been a lot of plagues in the history of man. And I don't know of any where somebody had to be tested to find out if he had one, you know?
Right.
And I just think that there's, you can get to people and subvert them to your point of view through humor and through, you know, through television, through film, you can. I mean, that's one thing Hitler really realized was like, that is, you know, the media and how powerful it is, and to completely encapsulate them and to surround them with your ideas and the way you think is a real warning for humanity that, you know, as we are dealing with right now, Tom, as you well know, you're seeing the consolidation of media. You're seeing the consolidation of the internet. You're seeing smaller and smaller number of avenues to express opinions, and that is being squeezed, and that is going to continue to get squeezed. And that's very dangerous and very interesting to see how the public is going to react to that. And like when, you know, when they talk about hate speech and they talk about it's, we are seeing now and witnessing now a real contraction and a real threat to free speech. And when for those who say, yes, but, it, you know, but these are private companies and they're allowed to do what they want. And it was for Congress to not enact laws that would limit free speech. And I get that. However, if these are public forums and if they have acting like public forums, and if these public forums like Facebook, like YouTube, if they are getting the protections, congressional protections, like for instance, they keep having these hearings in Congress, but no one's doing anything. I really feel like we have to like, I mean, the real, you know, I mean, Chomsky was pretty much Noam Chomsky, who I don't think anybody would argue is not, I mean, is not conservative. I don't think any person would say Noam Chomsky. And he says, you know, free speech, you know, hey, Joseph Stalin was for free speech, as long as you agreed with him.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite. We have to protect the speech of people who are repugnant, who say things. And it's very much like the Nazis in Skokie, Illinois. These are people that the ACLU, what they used to, I don't think they do it anymore, but in the 70s, when like 78 or 77, when the neo-Nazis wanted to have a parade in Illinois, the ACLU went to go fight for their right to have that march. And they did the right thing, because if we silence these people, then they can silence anybody. And I think right now, I think even repugnant speech, all speech needs to be protected. And the idea that somehow we need to be protected by them, or that there's some subclass of people who are so delicate that we need to protect these people from the words that they could hear, I think that is very elitist. And I also think that is very condescending to these groups, are very condescending to these people who can defend themselves. And I'm not talking about physically defending themselves. There are already laws on the books. And I'm so sick of hearing, like, you know, the great moron of the North, you know, the Prime Minister of Canada, to say, Justin Trudeau, to say that you can't, it's not legal to yell fire in a theater, in a crowded theater. Okay, that is such the most tired, boring, rundown argument and such illogical. There are already laws on the books for incitement of violence and for incitement or for endangerment for that.
Well, but not to mention, it depends on it's the theater owner's rules. Presumably a theater owner would have a rule saying, if you come in my establishment, you know that you can't threaten everybody with a riot by shouting out fire. Everybody gets that's the rule,
yeah,
on somebody else's private property. It's not analogous.
Right. It is not analogous. However, that is being stretched out into finding ways to, unfortunately, like even, yeah, I see comedians doing it, which is, to me, nonsensical. And then Sacha Baron Cohen, which was brilliant, you know, he's for trying to limit hate speech on Facebook. And look, these are horrible people. Let's make no mistake about that. These are not good people. But the idea of who gets to decide and what is hate speech, and then and who is really being protected, and who gets the final decision on that, and how far is that going to go, and what really is, what can you define it as hate speech. I mean, once you go down that path of contracting free speech, you're in trouble. And I tried to reach out to him, and I didn't hear back. But I did say, like, well, you know, when you in Borat, that very funny thing about, you know, he had like there was a festival in Kazakhstan or wherever that character Borat is from, about like throw the Jew down the well. No one in that theater was thinking that that was anything but just absurdity, absurd racism in these, you know, backwards people. And no one was going to take that and go throw a Jew down the well. So I think using his own logic against them, that I just don't think that that trying to limit what people could say, even if it's horrible, we have to be really careful to draw a line there and say, I think people can decide for themselves that throw a Jew down the well didn't mean throw a Jew down the well, that was making fun of racism. And that's what's scary now, is that you have like school districts in California that are deciding to take off To Kill a Mockingbird out of their school because there may be some insensitive words. And yeah, there could be insensitive words. However, can we look at the intent of what the writer is saying? And can we see that there is a bigger lesson here that has to do with morality and societal morality, individual morality, and immorality? Because we can also learn how to live our lives by examples of how you shouldn't live your life. So I think there's, Tom, I think we are going down a slippery slope, no doubt. I mean, I talked about this in 2015. I said fascism and totalitarianism is coming to America, and this time is coming from the left. And I saw that in its contractions of personal liberties. And we're seeing that now. And I don't know where it's going to lead, but I'm going to tell you what, it's going to get worse.
Hey, everybody, just a quick break to thank our sponsor, Harry's, the official razor of The Tom Woods Show. I'm about to improve your life, or at the very least, improve the lives of recipients of gifts from you. I'll tell you this, in general, the men in your life have gotten all the socks, all the ties, all the wallets they ever want to receive. And yet I get that we can be hard to shop for, and we want something practical and useful, and you don't know what to get for us. Well, how about this Christmas season, Harry's Holiday Shave Sets, the gift that's thoughtful and practical. You'll recall, years ago, I got that from Michael Malice, one of your favorite guests on The Tom Woods Show. It's a practical gift he'll actually use. Harry's makes sharp blades that last. It's the gift that keeps giving. Harry's blade refills are as low as $2 each, so your recipient will save money over time. And it comes ready to gift. Harry's Holiday Shave Sets, and I'm holding one in my hand right now, come in a prepackaged, handsome, holiday-themed gift box. They're beautiful. And you can even make it personal by engraving the razor handle, as I did for Michael Malice. Well, this holiday season, new customers can get $5 off plus free shipping on any Harry's limited edition holiday shave set when you go to harrys.com/woods. The sets come with a weighted handle, 3 razor cartridges, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover, all packaged in a handsome holiday gift box. Don't give socks this year. Delight the guys in your life with Harry's. To claim your $5 off plus free shipping, go to harrys.com/woods. I want to ask you as a comedian how you balance something. Because I saw Lewis Black last year do stand-up. And it was a good chunk of it was Trump is an idiot. And to me, that's just lazy. Because
it is. There's nothing.
You know, that's not funny.
Well, it's also pandering to your own audience. It's like I got into a beef with a bunch of people, and it got all over the media because they're. I said the jokes on late night TV are completely interchangeable. In other words, you know, Steve Colbert and Jimmy Fallon and the other guys, their jokes can be, you can just take them out from one guy's monologue and give it to the other guy. There's no individuality in there anymore because it's just they are in their own little, not the overused term, echo chamber of just kind of cheerleading. And it's no longer trying to challenge the audience, which I think good comedy should try to challenge them. It's just, you know, it's pandering, and it's also it's easy, and it's I get it's like some kind of indoctrination, political indoctrination by comedic imposition.
Well, I watched your Netflix special not too long ago, Asian Mama, Mexican Kids, which I enjoyed. First of all, when did you record that? It must have been before all the craziness.
Just right before, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, but like there's some stuff that I took out, and it was just some stuff about about racism and reverse racism, and how it's in people's minds that they're so worried about racism that they end up acting differently from it. And I just, like, at that time when I was, because it literally, we filmed it on February 29th, and then we, you know, basically the world shut down about a week later. And so there were some bits that I did take out. I mean, I do regret that, because I talked about, like, how, you know, Harvard University had limited the number of Asians. I said, the last people you can be prejudiced against are Asians. And I said, and Asians take it because they just don't want to rock the boat. I mean, then again, there was a lawsuit, you know, saying that you can't limit the number of Asian people at your university. And then Harvard University said, yeah, we can. And they went to court, and the court agreed with Harvard. Now, you try to limit the number of gay people at your university, women, lesbians, you know, trans people, they'll shut you. They'll burn your university down. Yeah. But if you do it with Asian people, they go, nah, they'll be fine. They're Asian, and they will be fine. That's the thing about it. So I do think that, like, you know, the idea of this democracy and this democracy and this republic that we're in is that it's going to be messy. And I don't think that, like, the democratic idea of cleaning it all up is going to do anything but make it worse, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Vegas. I stayed at the MGM Grand. They actually, at the MGM Grand, they've opened a couple of shows, actually. So I saw David Copperfield, who's always great, a couple of shows. But then they had a comedy club, and I love going to comedy clubs, but I actually decided not to, just because, I guess, not like I approve of everything Trump does, but I don't want to sit through a Trump's an idiot rant, and I can't guarantee that it's not going to be that.
Yeah, no, it is. To me, it's not a challenge at all. To me, what I tried to do was challenge the audience by going the other way. But I went with, like, the idea of, and this is a few years back, when, you know, the idea of, for people who were still complaining about Trump 2-3 years in, was analogous to, like, complaining about your pilot once you're already in the plane at 30,000 feet. It's too late at that point to go, hey, this guy's a racist, this guy's an asshole. You know what? You know, it's like, hey, and the way that I described is, let's not distract our pilot. Obviously, this pilot is of Trump is very easily distracted. He's on Twitter in the cockpit for sure. You know, can we just, let's just land the plane? Because guess what? We're on the plane too. Okay. Let's all land this together.
Yeah.
And and that kind of gets through. Because the idea is I think you need to be, you know, I just quoted this, you know, the artist Banksy the other day, because I had a couple of people that complained for my show the other night. And I said, you know, as the artist, the British street artist Banksy says, the idea of art is to comfort the discomforted and to discomfort the comfortable. And I think that's what we really need to do. And I think you had to challenge people. And the good ones, the best ones do that. And, you know, the idea of George Carlin, you know, shitting on the government and stuff, it's fun and it's great. And it's also, he's saying something, but you have to be there to entertain. And also not just to just tell people what they want to hear. That's true. I mean, I think I want to challenge the audience. And now is a very good time. I mean, I have to remember, A, that I'm there to entertain, but I also have to entertain myself as well. That's the tough part. And nudge them along. And I say, you know, because there are people that are really scared. And there are people that are, you know, my mother's 92. She got this virus and recovered from it. And so I had it. You know, it ain't a walk in the park. But for most people, it goes right through their body. And it's a 99.8% recovery rate. And for people under 65, it's even higher. So it's, you know, these are facts from the CDC. This is not something controversial. But you have to respect the fact that people are afraid and the people are inundated. And that's where the power of propaganda comes in. And if you look at it historically, if you look at where propaganda was actually with a congressional record, where it was approved to have congressional approval and a law, and for propaganda was under the, you know, Woodrow Wilson administration, where they were like, hey, you know, and he was against the union activists and also any anti-war people, and just literally threw them in jail without, and their constitutional rights were just thrown out. So it can happen, and it happened then, and it can happen again. So the idea of, like, a war very, very far away back, you're talking about, like, where 80% of Americans were farmers back then. The ones who didn't live in the city, if you're talking World War One now, they didn't want to be, you know, Europe was way over there. I mean, you thought Europe was way over there. New York was way over there. you know? So the idea of getting involved in some war that was way over there in Europe was just seemed like it was none of our business. And that was part of the, so what the propaganda was done was like, hey, we got to get these Hun, well, you know, they're tearing apart Belgian babies. And it's like the farmer, you'll get a farmer in America to put down his hoe at that point and go, excuse me, what? Who's doing what? Yeah, there are these Belgian babies. They're getting ripped apart by these Hun. Who are these Hun people? Well, these German people over there. And the next thing you know, you get people, and then it turned the tide. And then people say, yeah, let's go over there. But it's all a lie. So it's this manipulation and this propaganda. It does work. So it's interesting when, like, when you can also decide what you decide not to say or how you decide. And so you have like a kind of inverse propaganda where people are excluding unfortunate facts or uncomfortable truths. And that's what we're seeing in our media now. And again, it's a it's a consolidated media, and there are fewer outlets. And if you step out of line, like you did, Tom, they're going to say, even though what you had was scientifically confirmed by some scientists, that's not the right science anymore. Because like I said, science is now politicized.
Now, having said all these things, you might... Well, here's the thing I want to ask you. I had Vince Vaughn on the program, and I asked him, you know, you have... He was a Ron Paul supporter. He's been fairly outspoken about his political views. Does this ever get you into any trouble with other celebrities? And he absolutely, resolutely insisted that, nope, not at all, no problems at all. Now, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe I touched a nerve. Like, maybe he didn't want to talk about it. I don't know. And maybe that's true. I don't know.
Well, I think he's a big enough star, and I don't think he's an... the problem with, you know, political identification is like the idea that somehow America is only represented by two distinct groups only is silly. I mean, I'm a 1970s liberal, which apparently makes me a huge conservative now because I want equality, you know, equal rights. And like, and so this whole thing, equity, was new to me. Like, well, we don't just want equal rights. We want more than equal rights. We want, because we're not just, we've also been, you know, we're not just, we're not white. We're gay, and we're Thai, and we're also trans. And so there's this idea that there's this multiple, that you should get more because you have these more inequities. And so that is new to me. So I guess if I'm not up to that, I think everybody should be treated equal and not be judged on the color of their skin. And yet there are some universities now in America that it is a shame, but that exists, though. It says, these seats are for people of color, and like, not for white people. And that the white people, I said, shit, are we going back to 1962 here? What? I mean, so I just, again, trying to make the world better, be careful that you don't make it worse. But as far as to answer your question, yeah, I'm sure that I've gotten some shit from it. I mean, from my political views. But my political views are to be the contrarian. And so I don't agree with everything the Republicans do. I mean, I'm definitely more of an environmentalist than most the Republican Party is. I definitely think that there's, you know, I align myself with more libertarian views for sure. I mean the idea of individual liberty, I think that's what this whole thing was, this whole country was founded on. And so I think that there was a departure by the Democrats to where they really were looking out for the poor. I think, like, I really do believe, I mean, I know Robert Kennedy Jr. and he's a good man, and his father was a really good man, Robert Kennedy. And I do really believe that he had an awakening, because this is a guy who also was like working with Joe McCarthy, you know, was a zealot against communism with McCarthy. But I think he really did have an awakening when he saw what some Americans lived in Mississippi, and the poverty, and the depth of the poverty, and the generational poverty. That shook him. And I think that's there's still great disparity now in America. And so, and like, I go back to like what I talked about, Noam Chomsky, and my idea, you know, I really do agree with him that like Americans can have really, are allowed to have fierce conversations and fierce debate and argument up until very recently, but only on a very narrow number of things. If you really want to find out, like, you know, this, about what are the real issues and how we can improve the human condition, I'm in. I'm all in. But let's not get sidetracked in the superfluous stuff that's happening on the university campus. And I say this, Tom, and I mean this to everybody out there listening. We are all on campus now. It's official. Campus is no longer on campus anymore. It's out there. We're all part of that now. So it's in politics, this whole woke thing. And if it gets in the courts, that's when it's going to be real trouble.
Yeah. I just remember being on campus in the early 90s and thinking, well, if any of these crazies ever got in power, then we'd be in real trouble. But thank goodness they're just on the campuses. And now I think we're getting a taste of what could be in store for us. Well, listen, you've been super generous with your time. I don't want to keep you. But before I let you go, can you just say a quick word about your Netflix special?
Well, I mean, it's I really wanted to do something that was about, my mixed heritage and how, like, the problem with, the blessing of mixed heritage is that you're exposed to, like, my dad was Jewish, my mom's Filipino. And the problem is you don't really feel belong. Sometimes you don't feel like you belong to either. Or so you belong to no one, to no group. And, but that as an artist, and sometimes you think about that as a young person, that it makes you very sensitive. And it takes 20, 30 years for you to realize that's your strength as an artist. And then I just wanted to do something that was, some of the jokes that I had done the last few years and just put it out there for people to see. And then I work on something else. And I was lucky to get it out there. And I was very happy that Netflix decided that they liked the material and put it on their platform. And I'm going to work on the next part. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. And because I really feel like as we are going down this road, there's going to be more and more people at this tribalism that's happening in America. Whereas it's like, they're killing people in their own tribe who don't vomit their own virtue signaling, So it's their virtue spewing, is what I like to refer it. And if you dare step out of line with that, or if you you're out forever. And that's fine for me because I never feel like I fit in any group anyway. And I think as an outsider, the great comedian Will Rogers was in America, and he critiqued the Republicans and Democrats, and you never knew really where he stood if you ever read any of his writings. And he just was able to mock and deserving of both sides. I mean, the idea that everything's going to be fine because the Democrats are in power, I would say, whoa, just wait. I will say, though, that like it does feel like there's a big sigh of relief, and you're not going to have the same kind of attack dogs in the media, in the liberal media, that you had when Trump was in power. And I'm all for both. I mean, I think you have to, you have to dig in and do your dirty work. And I just, it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen because, the free pass that Obama got, while as he had never been any more, has never been a greater attack on journalists and whistleblowers than under the Obama administration. That doesn't seem to come up. And, just ask people in Libya what happened to that country. So I will continue to critique anybody in power. And I think that needs to happen. And hopefully the media, and whether it's just it ends up being like a license plate for Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post, it's like a vanity plate for him, But at the end of the day, I'm hoping that they can regroup and not just, be journalists by name, but to really dig in and do stuff. Because it is irritating. Like, I really like Glenn Greenwald. He's extremely liberal. He's all for socialism.
Yeah, but he's honest.
He's honest. And you can really talk to him. And he will critique both sides. And both sides do need the critiquing. And see the phoniness of it. And especially this new group that is going to come into power. Because unfortunately, my prediction is that they will be bombing places in 8 months. I hate to say that, but if you take a look at American foreign policy, whether it's Republican or Democrat, it doesn't change. They just want to keep going around smashing up the world, and they're going to try to get other people to pay for it because there's a lot less money here now. So we just have to keep an eye open and to use the same scope for people in power and to keep that checked. Unfortunately now, with like what you're seeing, is that there are going to be further, impinging on personal liberties and freedoms and the freedom to speak your mind and the freedom to critique people in power. And that is very worrisome. That worries me more than anything.
Well, you and me both. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go, but I can't tell you how much I enjoyed talking to you and that we were able to make this happen. I'm going to link to your special also to robschneider.com.
Thank you, Tom.
On the show notes page. Yeah, it's tomwoods.com/1787. That means we have done 1,787 of these blankety-blank episodes over the years.
Fantastic.
And thanks so much again for doing it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
All the best to you, Tom. Continued success for you. I wish you the best.
All right, folks, that's our episode for today. Now, if you did not get the message through my newsletter or through some of the other episodes recently, I moved my private group off Facebook. I had a private group where intelligent people gather and we keep each other sane, especially during these crazy times, and we do you the courtesy of not automatically assuming you want to murder your grandmother. And this is the kind of group that we could all stand to be part of at a time like this. You can interact with me and other great folks in there. And I had been resisting this for a long time. I thought people aren't going to join me on another platform. The group's just going to die. But to the contrary, we've had quite a few people move over to MeWe, which is the platform on which the group can be found now. Now, I still have a page on Facebook, and I feel like if there's an audience, I want to reach that audience. So I'm not just going to abandon it altogether, but I took my group off there. So now we can function without having to worry about somebody looking over our shoulder. Not that we're up to no good, but for heaven's sake, it's hard to know what you're allowed to say from day to day. You can't even argue that the lockdowns are ineffective or a bad idea, because then that gets fact-checked. It's completely ridiculous. So if you like and appreciate what I'm doing, you will be like a kid in a candy store as a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show because of all the bonuses you get, not least of which is membership in that group, which I call the Tom Woods Show Elite. Membership is via supportinglisteners.com. Supportinglisteners.com is a website for that. So go over there and do that. Join me in that group. Let's embrace freedom, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.